Good morning and welcome to Thy Strong Word here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. I'm Randy Asbury, sitting in once again for William Whedon, who's on his Christmas vacation these days. And for some reason, he gets a parish pastor to fill in for him, like we have nothing else to do. But I'll be talking with him about this. You can bet on that. But it's a joy to be with you here today to study God's Word, to proclaim it, hear it, read it. It's wonderful stuff, and we have a wonderful chapter in front of us here today. Last time, we had a chapter chock full of God's judgment and fury. God's sword was sated with blood, we read, and the cities of Edom were barren of people, and wild animals were moving in. Today, though, we have a chapter chock full of God's grace and mercy and promise and hope. Isaiah 35 gives us such a beautiful picture of God's redemption. Deserts become lush and blossom with life. Weak hands and feeble knees become strong again. The blind see, the deaf hear, and a smooth and safe highway leads God's people home. The ransomed shall return is the heading in the Lutheran Study Bible here. So what a wonderful passage to talk about here on Thy Strong Word. And we do thank our underwriter, Lutheran Heritage Foundation. Check them out, lhfmissions.org. We thank them for their support and enabling this program to continue as we get to study God's Word. You can join the conversation. Just give us a call at 314-821-0850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us kfuo@kfuo.org. We'd love to have your questions and comments. It's only 10 verses here, so we need to get quite a discussion going here. So please call in, email in, all that good stuff. Joining us to help unpack and explain and rejoice in this Isaiah chapter 35 is Pastor Nathan Metter. He's pastor at St. John Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Wisconsin. Good morning, Pastor Metter, and welcome to Thy Strong Word.
Good morning, Randy. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I actually, almost ready for everything, this minor little inconvenience that we're going to have later this week, where we get to see all the people who come to church once or twice a year, plus all the regulars.
Minor little inconvenience? Yeah, what is this all about?
Let me get my tongue firmly out of my teeth.
Good. I thought we'd clarify that.
Here at St. John, we'll have 1,500 of our closest friends over the course of five services, so it'll be quite an adventure. We're still one of those communities where unique. Plymouth is one of those unique communities where the kids still come home.
No matter how
as busy as the kids get with their schedule and their grandkids, there's still the culture that everybody comes home to Plymouth for Christmas. So
go home for Christmas. Well, that must be where all the folks from St. Louis are going then. I know here we have kind of the opposite, where people like to travel elsewhere to be with family.
Well, I grew up in Edwardsville, so I understand that, and I'll be down there. I don't get to come down until New Year's to see my mom. My mom and stepdad still live over in Glen Carbon, so I'll be down in the neighborhood. So don't alert the authorities. They may want to talk to me.
Your secret is safe with me.
That and all of our listeners. I think there is something unique about this Wisconsin. Lutherans in Wisconsin, especially. I've served up here for the vast majority of my ministry. I've served up here, and there is still that sense that while when the kids graduate from high school, the first thing they want to do is show their taillights to the world. But boy, when stuff starts to get real in their life, and Mr. or Miss Wonderful come along, and it's time to have that next generation, there is just this desire to come home.
What did Dorothy say? There's no place like home.
Dorothy, I've been to Kansas, and no offense to our listeners and friends in Kansas, Wisconsin's a lot prettier, and you understand why you come home. Although this year this year's been kind of weird. As I was talking to Buzz before we came on, and old El Nino has. He's killing the snow industry because we had one dusting of snow It's going to be in the 40s. They're talking it might be 50 degrees on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, same thing here. We haven't even had a dusting of snow, I don't think. Maybe a little chilly now and again, but it's pretty balmy in St. Louis right now, too.
I was down for meetings a couple of weeks ago with the Office of National Missions, and it was very pleasant down there to not have to run around with a coat. So
right. Well, good. I'm glad you are getting ready for Christmas and the great joys of preaching and teaching and singing the hymns on Christ's incarnation. Just fabulous. I mean, for us pastors, it is a busy time, and no, we don't get to go home and be with family, but it is wonderful because we get to plumb the depths of this great mystery that God became flesh for us.
Yes. Yeah, that, you know, and that, I was talking at one of our older members comes in today, and he says, he asked me flat out, he says, is this an easy time of year or a hard time of year to be a preacher? And I looked at him, and with all seriousness, I said, yes, you know, not because I'm a Lutheran, but because I really do believe that it is an easier time of year because, you know, we don't, the folks who are gathered, there's a level of expectation, but sometimes it's harder because, you know, we're tasked with, we're tasked with proclaiming the same message every year at Christmas time, you know. And how do I avoid the temptation of repeating what I said last year? But I think you made a great point. There is a depth to this. There's a depth even to a text like Luke 2 that you can. There are many years worth of Christmas sermons before you reach the bottom.
Right, yeah. And no matter how many times you preach it or even just read it in your home, there's always something that pops out. It's so familiar and yet so much depth, as you said. In fact, I remember one time reading a sermon from Martin Luther on Christmas and thinking, okay, he's going to talk about baby Jesus and all this. And no, he talked about the teaching of vocation. And I thought, I had never thought of that before, but it's exactly right.
Well, and not to give away that's kind of, you know, the ordinariness of everything.
Yes,
everything. If you're just looking, I was working on Luke 2 before we set it aside to get to Isaiah 35 here for a little while, and there is something incredibly ordinary about everything in that text. Those 20 verses, with the exception of the angels. Everything else,
that is a very good point.
So absolutely ordinary, you know, which is one of the reasons why you look at those phrases, you know, the phrase that comes in, it comes in three times, and it came to pass, and it happened, you know, and what an ordinary construction, you know, a typical Hebrew, you know, Hebraism, you know, the vav consecutive in there that just simply says this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and oh yeah. In the middle, you've got the angels and the glory of the Lord, and everybody's showing up. And what do they find? A normal little baby.
Right.
Yeah. You know, there is something incredibly ordinary about it, but there's something incredibly ordinary about what we see.
But I think I'm hearing your sermon title come out here: Incredibly Ordinary.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, yeah, exactly. It's getting close.
Okay. Well, tell you what, let's shift gears here from Luke 2 to Isaiah 35, since that's
there's nothing ordinary about this text.
Yeah, this is pretty amazing stuff here. The ransomed shall return is the heading that the English Standard Version gives it here. What's going on in this? Set the stage. Give us some context here.
Well, you're dealing with, you know, Isaiah. You know, this is the Isaiah is it's such a beautiful book. I mean, they call him the fifth evangelist, but
right.
What you see in here is this constant proper distinction of law and gospel. Okay, one of the things as I've done a lot of preaching on the prophets this fall. I have a good friend, Pastor Nabil Noor, and I work together with
him. Oh, sure.
You know, Hebrew is next to a mother tongue to Nabil, and so we spend a lot of time talking on the phone about the Old Testament, and he's helping me bone up on my Hebrew a little bit. But what you see is this ongoing proper distinction of law and gospel, and the fact that God's wrath never is His last word. God's wrath is never His last word, even and especially to people for whom it should be. You know, so you have this, you know, as Isaiah plays out, you know, you have this ebb and flow of of unfaithfulness and judgment, and then you have this unfaithfulness and then judgment, and then this restoration. And the restoration is never forgotten in the book of Isaiah. It's that constant reminder. It's really, really bad right now. Okay, you guys have really messed this up. Okay, you've done the unthinkable. You know, you've had this wonderful God who has provided for you so richly and abundantly and lusciously, and you have, you've thumbed your nose to him, you stuck your tongue out, whatever little euphemism you want to use, and you're saying, I'm not going to do it your way, I'm going to do it my way, and which is never a good choice course of action. Even if you do like Sinatra, doing it my way is not a good thing. And as a result, what happens is then judgment comes along. And as you were talking about, that there's 34 has judgment on the nations, and again, it's God executing that. But these folks who are hearing this message, they should be hearing God's law. Their unfaithfulness has risen to the level that, the northern 10 tribes have been carried off thanks to their wonderful neighbors, the Assyrians. And as the next chapter, so it's really interesting. We're sitting between judgment on the nations and then the impending judgment that could very well fall on Judah, as the Assyrians, who have just wiped out the northern 10 tribes, they're coming calling and they're not selling Avon.
Right. We've been talking about that in the previous chapters, how Hezekiah and the other leaders are thinking, we need to go to Egypt for an ally here. And God says, don't do that. Bad choice.
Yeah, again, we're going to do it my way. We're not going to do it God's way, and yet, as the impending doom, the northern 10 tribes, they've lost it. The Assyrians have overrun them. They've completely, they, for all intents and purposes, they cease to exist, and the same kind of fate seems to be impending on Judah. Except this is where we get this, but it's not yet. As we see, it's not yet. These oracle words of warning. Listen, if you do it your way, you're going to end up like those guys. If you do it my way, here it is. And yet, even in the midst of all of that, God is still speaking these words of restoration. You don't go very far in these between oracles of judgment to these wonderfully sweet words of gospel.
It's almost like a ping pong ball here.
Yeah.
One side is judgment, the other side is the grace and mercy and restoration of God, and we keep going
Isaiah
back and forth here.
Isaiah would have made a great Lutheran.
Lutheran.
Law, gospel. But the beautiful thing is, it's never formulaic. And when you run across it, it's amazing how you go from Isaiah 34 to 35. And the last thing you would expect is reading 34 is to come in something as sweet as 35.
Yeah, exactly,
And that's one of those things. When you need, and it's that bitterness that makes the bitterness of the judgment that God speaks of makes the gospel that much sweeter.
Right, and knowing how sick we really are in our sin, to know how good the medicine is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right, well, let's get into Isaiah 35 here, verses 1 and 2. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice and blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. So here we have a desert coming back to life. Yeah. Tell us more.
Well, actually, as I was reading this, one of the things that is so amazing, you see the image, if you ever watch the nature shows, where you ever watch the shows where they specialize, we look at a desert and we think it's completely dead, and there's all kinds, there's a lot more life there than you think. And then you see that image where it almost looks like time-lapse photography, but really isn't, that when all of a sudden rain falls on the desert, it just explodes in color and life.
Mm.
And it does that because that's the nature of the desert. You don't know when the next rain shower is coming, so that's when all the critters, that's when all the plants do their blooming and their pollinating and they're reproducing, and that's when the animals are out. And but there's a new life that happens until the old death of the desert comes back, that comes back to it. But as I first read this, you know, it's amazing to me. What really jumped out at me is how this is really it's really talking about how God the same image that God, how God undoes Genesis 3. You know,
what do you mean he undoes Genesis 3?
Undoes Genesis 3 in the fact where you look at the in Genesis 3 there are two curses. There's one that falls on the serpent.
Right. The cursed are you.
Right, and the other falls on creation.
Right.
And creation is because of the enmity. You know, there's enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. But there's also in the curse that falls on the ground is born by Adam and Eve. Okay, and that creation which was intended to serve man now starts to work against him. Thorns and thistles and all kinds of stuff.
By the sweat of your brow.
Right, sweat of your brow, pain in childbirth, all that great stuff that you sit there and you go, man, what did you do that for? You know, our life could have been so much easier.
And it is fascinating, back in Genesis 3, I'm curious what you think about this, but mm-hmm. I've noticed that the serpent gets cursed, the creation gets cursed, but Adam and Eve do not get cursed.
Correct. That's a major thing. When you sit there, they bear the brunt of the curse.
Right.
But they don't. They're not cursed. You know, they're not cursed. You know, and again, even there you see the patience of God, the forbearance of God, the mercy of God. You know, because he could have, like a typical 3-year-old. You know, when you're drawing your little picture, you know, you give them a sheet of paper and they're coloring, and all of a sudden they make this one stray line and they crumple it up and they want to start over. But that's not how God works.
Right.
That's not how God works. Yes, yes, there is curse there, but the beautiful thing, you know, this, and this is where Genesis 3 gives you the illustration, and I believe this is where, you know, where we can draw some heave for Isaiah 35. When God goes to work, he takes that stray line and turns it into a masterpiece, or restores it into a masterpiece. Not unlike if you've ever, I ran across a video not long ago of a mother who, she has a 3-year-old child, and she sits her down with a new sheet of big canvas and hands her a marker and says, doodle. And this child just scribbles aimlessly all over the place. But then after the child is done, gets bored, walks away, mom then gets the watercolors out and turns it into a work of art.
Hmm, interesting.
And this is really what, this is where the mercy of God comes in.
Well, it does show the mercy of God, doesn't it, that he did not just scrap it all and start over.
Correct. His intent was, you know, he will take, you know, the masterpiece of creation, which was very good at the end of the creative process, and he is going to make it good again. He's going to make it good again, and that's why even amidst, you know, that's why the psalmist can talk about this cursed creation, this cursed ground, still declares the handiwork of God.
You know, yes, right.
And that's the beautiful thing. When you see when that drop of rain hits the parched earth of a desert, you know, everything comes back to life. And that's where the gospel comes in.
Right.
You know, that when the glory of the Lord comes around, you know, and you know, the rain shower of the gospel falls on a cursed, parched land, new life comes in. So if you set it in context, in the midst of all this judgment and wrath and bloodshed, now God is still going to act, not in his alien work, which is the stuff he just has to do because we force him to, his proper work, that proper work of pardon, forgiveness, new life. And when that proper work falls on creation, not just us, but on all creation.
Right. Well, I cannot help but think of Romans chapter 8 here, mm-hmm. where it talks about all creation groaning, waiting with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it.
Right.
And so we almost see here in Isaiah 35, God promising this restoration even of creation.
Yeah, you know, and here is where this text, these little 10 verses, you know, we're looking at them. You know, you could just look at them as 10 verses, but really, there's a depth to their fulfillment. You know, there's a depth to their fulfillment. It takes you all the way back to the mess our first parents made. It can take you to it you know, and you can see, but then you also see how it sits in the history of the tribes of Israel at the time. You know, because there is going to be judgment and restoration. But then you also see it, and as we get to the later in the verses, you see that this is clearly a messianic text, especially the way Jesus uses it.
Yes, so, right. So, we'll get to some of that here in the next section,
so,
especially.
So we're looking. There is a painting within a painting within a painting within a painting here.
Okay.
It's amazingly complex. These few verses, you know, you sit there. And there is an amazing depth to this that almost humans can't fathom. It's just, this is God at work.
Yeah. Okay.
This is God at work.
Okay, Pastor, what about the wilderness itself, the first couple words of the chapter? Is this a particular area of Palestine, or is this just meant to be all of creation?
Well, what they do is they take God does this, his prophets do this, Jesus does this. He takes the area that they're talking about, the Arabah, and he takes something that they know to illustrate something that he wants them to know.
Okay.
So as they see this area, this wilderness area, this is okay. And as you look, the next verses even point out, what you can start to see is there also is an allusion, I think, to the first time that the Israelites entered the Promised Land.
You know? Okay.
So you see they're out in the wilderness, they're wandering around, and what doesn't the wilderness have? It doesn't have water, it doesn't have food, it's not a hospitable place, and yet what does God do for the people as they wander around? You know, their sandals don't wear out and their feet don't swell.
And he gives them food.
He gives them everything, and he provides for them, again, while it's miraculous, through creation. God uses the in a very very sacramental kind of way, as miraculous as the manna was. What was it? It was the frost came, and then the little coriander seed like things would be left on the ground.
Right.
And then they'd go out and pick them up and make bread.
Yeah.
And then the quail would wander around, and quail not a notoriously smart bird, quail and pheasant are very similar. That if you have them in the right areas, they'll walk up to the end of your gun. you don't have to work very hard, especially the farm stocked one around here.
Yeah, here, come and shoot me, please.
Well, yeah, they'll like, oh, look, you have a gun. Can I say hi, bang? You're under glass. But that's how God, God did not send takeout from bandanas, okay? He even amidst the miraculous, he still used the elements of creation.
The ordinary means, sort of thing.
Back to ordinary again.
Right.
Yeah, we're back.
That's right.
Real
quick before we go to a break here,
sure.
In verse 2, it talks about the glory of Lebanon, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. And I remember back in chapter 33, these same places were mentioned, but they were withering away, and Sharon is like a desert, and they take off their leaves. So we have a very stark contrast here, don't we?
Well, yeah. In their normal state, Lebanon, Carmel, Sharon, those were all verdant areas. Those were all the verdant areas where there was always life. But then under judgment, they become lifeless. But then under God, God's last word is never judgment. His last word is always restoration, reconciliation. And when the dew of that, or the rain of that falls down, to use Luther's, when the passing rain shower of the gospel, guess what happens? New life.
Okay.
Instantly. And again, you see, there's an element of resurrection in this too.
Indeed. We're going to take a short break here. We're talking with Pastor Nathan Metter about Isaiah chapter 35. When we come back, we'll get into the next few verses and find out how they apply to Jesus, or how Jesus applies them to himself. I'm Randy Asbury. We'll be right back.
When John the Baptist is born, his father says, God has visited and redeemed his people. What is Zechariah talking about? Live Monday on Issues Etc., we'll have Pastor Tom Baker lead us in a Sunday school lesson on the birth of John the Baptist. We'll also look forward to Sunday morning with Dr. Carl Fakencher.
Issues Etc., live weekday afternoons from 3 to 5 on KFUO.
Hi, I'm Andy Bates, host of Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO, and I'd like to let you know about a new free resource to assist you and your family as you join together in prayer. Visit lcms.org/unwrappingthegifts to find litanies, table graces, and more to support you in your times of prayer as a family. That's lcms.org/unwrappingthegifts.
Hi, I'm Reverend Matthew Heisey. As executive director of the Lutheran Heritage Foundation, I've traveled around the world to places like Mongolia, Ethiopia, Thailand, and Venezuela. With each stop, I've been struck by the number of people passing me on the street who know nothing about the true God, who takes away their sins and mine. This Advent, join LHF in sharing the story of our Savior, Jesus Christ, to people far and wide in a language that they can understand. Learn more at lhfmissions.org.
Welcome back to Thy Strong Word here on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news. We are coming to you live from the LCMS International Center on this Monday, December 21st. I think a lot of folks are out on Christmas vacation, but those of us who are dedicated are right here as we discuss God's Word with Pastor Nathan Metter. We're in Isaiah chapter 35. Before we get back to the chapter itself, Pastor Metter, a couple questions from James. He sends them in by email here. And by the way, we'd love to have your questions too. Send them in email, kfuo@kfuo.org, or you can call in 314-821-0850 in the St. Louis area, or outside of the St. Louis area, 1-800-730-2727. A couple questions from James by way of email. First of all, Pastor Metter, he asks, what is the proper perspective that should be processed about Zion and kingdom restoration that will enhance my moral imagination about the true messianic kingdom and God's providence? Wow, there's a lot there.
Wow.
I'm not exactly sure what he means by moral imagination.
I think to steal away again to what I'm working with for later this week. I don't know that we need to be grand. I don't know that we need to be grand.
I really think
the essence of the kingdom restoration is indeed ordinary.
Yes, yes.
There is something indeed ordinary, and what we are being taken back to. Again, as you look to the ultimate restoration on the last day, there are some wonderful, amazing little parallels that if you want to connect the first two chapters of Genesis with the last two chapters of Revelation, and you get this understanding and this visual image that what is going to be new is very much what we were intended to have all along. So it's really what we're being taken back to while it's extraordinary for us because of the world in which we live, because where we live and move and have our being is a world that's corrupted by sin and death. Okay, but what God is taking us to is the ordinary, the situation normal that He intended us to have from the beginning. So I don't know that I need a grand moral imagination as much as I simply need to see the ordinariness of the way God chooses to work, mm-hmm. the ordinariness of how, you know, the means by which He works, and then the ultimate ordinariness of where He's taking us, which is a restored kingdom where we will, you know, we will have everything we need. Creation's not working against us anymore. The body doesn't work against us anymore. Sin and death don't work against us anymore. But God, we have Him face to face.
Well, you kind of answered the other question he brought up here that I was going to bring about, connecting it to Revelation 22. I mean, this picture in Isaiah 35 both goes back to the original creation, Genesis
Correct.
1, 2, and 3.
You know, Correct.
It was very good, but then when Adam and Eve fell into sin, then came the thorns and the thistles and the cursed ground, the cursed serpent, like we talked about before. But it also looks ahead, doesn't it, to
Right.
Revelation, the last couple chapters you said, but 22, as James pointed out here. The creation, the paradise will be restored. And that's what we have going on here in this chapter of Isaiah.
Where it even becomes, and that's where it gets, that's, you know, the restored creation is even, you know, we're talking where the fruit is in season every month.
Yes.
It's not ordinary for us, but it's ordinary if you follow the plan.
Exactly. Well, let's get to the next couple of verses here. Verses 3 and 4, Isaiah chapter 35. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God. He will come and save you.
Yeah.
Now this is an amazing couple of verses here. You know, strengthen those weak hands. I mean, when I think of weak hands, I'm thinking of hands that might be shaking or
Absolutely.
Something like that. I remember the first time I ever did a piano concert in college. I was taking lessons, and part of the requirement was I had to do a recital. And I kid you not, Pastor Metter, my hands were shaking so visibly, and they also felt like electricity was just bursting through them. Like I couldn't control them.
Exactly.
So it's that kind of picture that Isaiah's bringing here, right?
Absolutely. Well, and you can understand why the people of that day would be that, because Assyria's knocking on the front door.
Yes.
You know, and they've seen what Assyria. You know, these are not nice people. You know, the emperor, the ruler of Assyria, you know, is purported to, you know, for dinner entertainment for his guests would be skin one of the captives alive. You know. These are not happy people to have them move in your neighborhood, and because they know what's going to happen. If you're a Star Trek The Next Generation fan, you can almost get the fact that it's, you know, they can almost see the Assyrians like the Borg.
Ah, there you go. Now you're talking my language.
There you go. Resistance is futile. We are going to take you. We are going to assimilate you. You are going to become like us. And the reputation again was not a pretty is not a pretty image, and of course they're terrified, you know, and rightfully so. You know, we have this, you know, God has indeed instilled in human beings this wonderful gift of common sense, that when, you know, that there is this fight or flight mentality, and we will, you know, when confronted by it, even when we fight, even when we choose fighting over flight, there is still that sense. You know, that impending fact that, you know, I may not get out of this alive. You know, and those of listeners who've seen combat understand what that's like. You know, and yet, you know, here is God saying, all right, now why? And here, why is Assyria coming down? It was for judgment. It was for judgment. The prophets had made that very clear. They're not just coming, you know, the Assyrians are not just coming down on a Sunday drive and say, oh, by the way, oh, look, there's the kingdom. Let's wipe them out. You know, they're here as an instrument of judgment. And yet...
an instrument of God's judgment. God was sending
right,
yeah. them.
You know, and you sit there, you know, you Assyria, as evil as they are, God's using them as an instrument for his purposes. And yet in the face of that, he says, don't be afraid. You know, be strong, fear not. Ooh, well, it sounds like the shepherds.
But right.
You keep
going back to that Luke 2, don't you?
You know what that's about, man.
That's right.
Everything in the course of a week can always be sermon prep.
That's right, Well, what about the last sentence there, verse 4? Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with the recompense of God.
Yes.
He will come and save you. I'm seeing different things here. I'm seeing vengeance and recompense, you know, payback or something, but that's tied to salvation. How does this work?
Right.
God's vengeance is our salvation.
Right.
How's that
God's
work?
God's vengeance, you know, he is, again, who bears, you know, who bore the curse? Who bore the original curse? You know, the serpent.
Mm-hmm.
So there is vengeance there. But God, you know, God will not leave sin unpunished. I did a chapel here a couple years ago that the kids still talk about. One of the problems is when your kid does something wrong, or one of your classmates does something wrong, your coworkers does something wrong, they apologize. Your first answer is, "Well, that's okay." Well, the answer is, "No, it's not. Sin is never
right.
okay. Sin is never okay. Sin will always, God will not leave sin unpunished." So the question is, how does He do this? And this is where, this is what He does. He chooses not to punish His people; rather, He chooses to punish His Son.
Take it to the cross.
Yeah, take it to the cross. There's a reason why the cross is a bloody mess and a painful experience for Jesus, because He's on both the physical and spiritual levels. Because He is experiencing the comeuppance, the vengeance, the justice that we deserve, so that He bears it, so that we don't have to, so that in exchange, we get what we don't deserve, and that is mercy and new life.
Yeah, so that we may be forgiven, so that we right. may go free, so that we right. may enjoy the new creation.
Right. He restores us
yeah.
so that we can be part. He restores us as part of that new creation. I think sometimes when we talk about justification as Lutherans, and sometimes we get so wrapped up into our forensic model where God is declaring human beings not guilty.
Yeah, the courtroom talk.
Yeah, that we forget indeed that there is a redemption of creation in the salvific plan. The creation was cursed because of us. So when we're restored and redeemed, so will they be restored and redeemed.
Right.
And that is where, and that's how He comes to save. He is that mighty hand and outstretched arm, just like He delivered people from Egypt. He delivered Israel from Egypt by that mighty hand and outstretched arm. He's going to do the same for us in the mighty hand and outstretched arms of Jesus.
We would love to have you join the conversation. 314-821-0850 in the St. Louis area. Outside of the St. Louis area, 1-800-730-2727. Or you can email us, kfuo@kfuo.org. Let's move on to verses 5 through 7. And these are some very important verses for Jesus Himself. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. For waters break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals where they lie down, the grass shall become reeds and rushes. We've kind of covered some of the desert becoming a pool earlier, but let's right. focus first on verses 5 and 6, the eyes of the blind shall be opened and so forth. These are verses that Jesus applies directly to Himself. And I'm thinking of the reading in Matthew 11.
Are you the one, or should we expect another?
Yeah, yeah. John sends his disciples yep. to Jesus, and John's in prison, and looks like he's having some doubts there. Is this the one? And he sends his disciples, go ask him, and they ask him, and he says, okay, you go back and tell John the eyes of the blind are open, the ears of the deaf unstopped, and so on. And almost like he's giving this code for, well, yes, it's me. Can't you tell from what I'm doing?
Yeah, but again, he never. It's really interesting because I'm a 3-year guy, so we just handled this. This was a gospel not too long ago, and it's really interesting to see. In the text. When the emissaries from John show up, Jesus keeps on doing what He's doing.
Right.
He doesn't turn around and say, he doesn't lecture. He just continues Nagelism. He just continues Messiah-ing. he just continues to be who he's been sent to be. And what is that? He's given sight to the blind. Deaf or unstopped and the lame are being healed and the tongues are, and then what then Jesus does is says, and oh yeah, by the way, I'm going to up that messianic by one more thing. The dead are raised, that's the image, and I think you get that. You can almost see that part of Jesus' illustration here where you talk about the death of desert, the death of
yeah,
the
yeah, okay.
comes to life. He says, and the dead are raised.
Well, I would say he even ups the ante yet more when he says, and the gospel is preached to the poor.
The poor, yes.
So now this is including all of us, isn't it?
Right, absolutely. And then that takes you back to that takes you back to Matthew 5. Is he talking about the guy who doesn't have lunch money, or is he talking about the guy who's poor in spirit? And that's really who he's really talking about, the ones who really need the Messiah. It's not just the one. It's not just the ones who have physical maladies, or spiritual, psychological maladies. It's ultimately the true illness that we have, the true malady that we have, is that sin separation from God.
Right.
And he's come in. When we realize that we are the poor in spirit, and guess what? Ours is the kingdom of heaven.
Right. So now, Pastor Metter, can I put myself in this passage, or the one in Matthew 11 where Jesus is quoting here? Am I the blind one? Am I the one with deaf ears? My eyes work. I need glasses, but they work. Other than that, my ears work.
Well, yeah, my optometrist pulled a nasty trick on me 3 weeks ago and put me in bifocals. So
you're only at the bifocal stage. I've got the tries.
God bless you, brother. I'm still
amazing things. You can look at different levels here.
Tilting my head all over the place now.
Yeah, right.
Text. But yes, they're in a very. The question is, which one are you? And the question is, it's all of the above. We all have these moments when we are. Paul talks about, what's our spiritual condition? We're blind, dead enemies of God.
So blind in my sin is probably the best way to apply this then.
Correct. This is not necessarily, right.
Or deaf to God's word or something like that.
Absolutely. The ears are stopped, Well, what stops it? Well, it's if you want to use the analogy, it's the hard encrusted wax of our sinfulness.
Used that from the pulpit before, yes.
Very nice. Great minds think alike.
That's right.
But finally, if you've had that, my youngest son has an issue with this, eventually, if all of a sudden you're looking at him, he's a seventh grader. Sometimes now I have to decipher, is it really the earwax buildup, or is it just because he's 12 years old and he's being an early teenager? Every once in a while he'll get that way, and I'll say, well, we got to clean your ears out. Why? Because you're not listening right now. And God does that. He unstops, and you start to think of the images that Jesus uses. You stick a finger in the guy's ear and spit. And all of a sudden, bang, his ear. And his tongue is loosed and his ears are opened. And you see the majesty of God, and yet how does he do all of this? And this goes back to how you took my upping the ante to upping the ante again. What does all of this? The good news being preached to the poor.
The gospel, yes. Well, and I love the tongue of the mute sing for joy phrase there, because we're coming into the Christmas season, and what do we like to do? Sing all those great Christmas hymns and singing the Christmas story and what it means.
About a year ago, I did a funeral for Henry Poth. Henry Poth was known as the Brat King of Sheboygan.
Brat King, okay.
Brat King, bratwurst, okay. If you've ever had a Johnsonville brat, Henry's brats were 10 times better.
Okay.
Careful, because I live, right now, I'm less than 5 miles from the factory where they make Johnsonville brats, so I got to be real careful when I say that. Henry was horrifically tone deaf. He made a great brat, but when you listen to Henry sing in church occasionally, he didn't do it very often, and when he did, it was a stretch to get to joyful noise. Okay? But there was one hymn that he would sing at the top of his lungs, and it was Silent Night.
Ah, okay.
He would belt that thing out, and you knew Henry was in church because he would belt it out, and it was awful. But it was at the same time, here's this man who couldn't sing to save his life, and yet the joy of what he experienced, he couldn't constrain himself.
And the singing for joy, yes.
Exactly, he would sing for joy. The joy. So you can almost, not only is it the mute guy who's singing for joy, it's the tone deaf guy who's singing for joy too.
Yeah, right.
Good. And you know what? And he said that for that one day, it wasn't painful to listen to Henry sing.
Yeah, I've had folks in my congregation over the years. Sometimes it's a young child, or sometimes somebody with maybe a mental disability, and they're singing like one or two beats behind everybody. Right, but you can tell the joy when they're doing that. Still.
Or when the little ones, or when the little ones are praying the Our Father.
Yes, yes.
At 3 decibels louder.
Yep.
And sometimes they're a little ahead, or they're a little behind. You know, and you want to make my heart sing. That's what I need right there.
There you go. Let's go to the phone lines here. We have James calling in from St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, James.
Hello. A question occurred to me while I heard you guys speaking of the depth and desert of the heart and refreshment and refreshing that was being talked about in this chapter. And I'd like to know if St. John chapter 7, verses 37 and 39, kind of speaks of that kind of messianic refreshing or something akin to it. And I'll hang up on this.
Okay, good question, James. Yeah, John 7, verses, I think he said 37 to 39 here.
Digging.
Where Jesus says, this is on the great day, on the last day of the feast. I believe this is the feast of dedication. I'll have to check that out here. But he says, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." Now, he said this about the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive, for as yet the Spirit had not been given because Jesus was not yet glorified. So that's the passage he's referring to there. Is this messianic?
Oh, I would think so.
Yes, I do too.
I would think, yeah, it's pretty clear. Those who, and again, I think this is where it then comes to us. Those who see and hear Messiah also then, by the gift of the Spirit, start speaking like that.
Yeah, okay, very good. Thanks, James. Appreciate you calling in there. Pastor, we better get the last few verses of our short chapter in here, verses 8 through 10. "And a highway shall be there, and it shall be called the Way of Holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. Even if they are fools, they shall not go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come upon it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away." So what's going on with this picture of a highway now?
Well, and this is one of the things I think, we're kind of spoiled a little bit. We don't fully grasp how dangerous travel was in those days. Because right now I can hop on an interstate at 70-ish or maybe a little more. Other than the toll booth I have to hit at Rockford, I can be where you're at within about 7 hours.
Right. Doesn't take long at all.
No, and I don't have to worry about bad guys coming to get me. I don't have to worry about, there's plenty of waysides and rest areas and services along the way. That's not what it was like back then. When you travel, especially if you travel by yourself, it was dangerous,
And it was probably just a dirt path most of the time, right? So a highway is pretty big compared to the normal means of transportation.
There was no Autobahn. There's no Autobahn there, and they marched, you walked through the fields and you walked over the crags of the mountains. And if you stepped and you missed step and the rock was loose, guess what? You're down in the ravine and you're in big trouble. And now what this is saying is, this highway, this paved road, it's going to be safe for travel. And then you see how that safe is, and it's going to be wide. You know where the path is. It's not like you're following, you're guessing where your next foothold is going to be, or your footfall is going to be. And there's not going to be anybody. There's no signs of those things that are working against you. The wild animals are not going to come up and have you for lunch. And you're gonna be there, and it's all the intent and purpose of getting you home, and again, this is, this is as we're preparing the Royal Highway Advent hymn, We understand, too, that this is not only a promise that, that God's people are going to come home to the land eventually, but that God's people are going to eventually come home to that new creation that, that, that we were intended to be part of.
Right. So in Isaiah's day, this was probably directly applicable to them, that they'd be coming home from exile.
Exile, right.
But for us as New Testament Christians, we're talking, again, going home to the new creation, to Eden, you know, restored, to heaven, we might say.
I talked about this in a very real way. We're in exile, too.
Yes.
You know, this is why I think I'm having a growing appreciation for the prophets, you know, because we are in exile, and we get this, you know, and we get this, this meaning, you know, God brings us home through the course of the week. He brings us to our temporary home, and that's the divine service. You know, where he brings us back in, that moment of refreshment, the gospel, the rain of the gospel falls into the desert that we've been living in, and righteousness springs up. You know, he feeds us, he nourishes us, but then we live the rest of the week in this period of exile. You know, and as each day goes by, it's clear that the world in which we are in exile is becoming less and less hospitable to the message that has claimed us.
Right. So the divine service might be our rest area along the
absolutely.
Freeway.
Absolutely. Or what a foretaste of the restoration to come.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's it going to be like to come home from exile? Well, you know, it's going to be like this, only even better. And then, you know, and that idea of deliverance and restoration that we have in the divine service then is just that snippet taste of what it's going to be like when we finally come home from our ultimate exile, not from Babylon, but you know, not from Egypt, not from Babylon, but home to the new creation, the new heavens, the new earth that God had in store for us from the beginning.
Home from the world of sin and death, to be sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just a couple minutes left here. What about the words redeemed and ransomed? They seem to be important words here.
Oh yeah.
What's it mean to be redeemed or ransomed?
To be redeemed is to be bought back. That means there's a price. You know. There's a price that needs to be paid, and this is where good Lutherans then go to this, you know, not with gold or silver, but with the holy precious blood, innocent suffering, and death of Jesus. It's a different kind of economy. You know, this is not a business trade. We are ransomed. The price has been paid to set us free from the slavery that we imposed upon ourselves. And we are redeemed. We are bought back. And, so as a result, we don't get there on our own. You can't redeem yourself. You know, somebody has to do the work for us. So we'll have the iPass or the whatever the thing so that we can be on that road, and it's going to be given to us. The Lord provides it. And where does that come from? It comes from that messianic figure who opened the eyes of the blind and unstopped the ears and caused mute tongues to sing for joy.
Yeah, pure gift, pure grace of God there.
All gift.
All gift, yes. Well, Pastor Nathan Metter, thank you very much for opening up Isaiah 35 for us and preaching the good news for us.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, the ordinary stuff here, we love it.
Very ordinary.
Well, blessings on your Christmas, and may it be very ordinary for you as well, and rejoicing in that ordinariness.
Absolutely. God bless, brother.
God bless you as well. And I'm Randy Asbury, sitting in for William Wheaton. I'll be back with you again tomorrow. We'll get into chapter 36. Looks like Sennacherib does invade Judah after all. We've been talking about it. Now we get a little historical account of what's going on and how King Hezekiah is ultimately going to respond. We'll talk with you tomorrow.